From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in February 1931 in Ohio. A girl named Chloe Anthony Wofford was born. The world would come to know her as Toni Morrison. And as a girl, Morrison grew up in a working-class family in Lorain, Ohio, the Rust Belt, where she and her family experienced consistent racism and discrimination. Morrison became one of the most acclaimed writers in American history, winning the Pulitzer Prize among many other awards. Her books, of course, include Beloved, Song of Solomon, A Mercy, and more. And she said that she wanted to keep the white gaze out of her writing. She once said that even great black writers like Frederick Douglass occasionally had the white gaze affecting their work. Morrison recently died at the age of 88. She spent six decades writing, essentially never stopping. She spoke openly of her own regrets in life, her views on race and white supremacy, and the power of literature. This hour is a chance to explore the themes and impact of her work with a panel of writers and teachers. In studio, our guests include Leslie Youngblood, the author of Love Like Sky. Great to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Takiya Graham, who's an English professor and founder of We All Write, Black Women's Writing Collective. Welcome back. Nice having you.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And with us is Lou Highsmith, who's a program director of Lou Creations Production, former leader of the Rock Bottom Slam Poetry Team, and a member of We All Write. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, I certainly wish it were a different occasion, but we are here to honor and celebrate the life of a woman who had such an impact on our world, our country. I've got some great clips we're going to listen to. And in fact, Leslie, there's a clip of Toni Morrison talking about some of her own writing that made me think directly of you, I will say.
Oh, wow.
We're going to get to those clips in coming up here, but I want to ask all of you to kind of just weigh in with your thoughts on the impact on the career and life of Toni Morrison. And I'll start with Takiya.
So I first read Toni Morrison in right after Beloved was published. And I was about 14, 15 years old. And I remember reading this book, not understanding a word of it, but falling in love. Like, I just knew that has been the only book I've ever claimed as my favorite book. And just as a black woman writer, black woman activist, a lover of all things black, she has definitely shaped my life because she has given me a script, some shoes that are too big to fill, but also a soft place to land when things get a little difficult for me. I can look to one of her books to speak my language and to offer some healing.
That's strong praise.
Strong praise. True, true.
Now, you were 14, well 15 deserved. When Beloved came out.
Yes, didn't understand a word.
You go back now and do you think, boy, you know, as a 14, 15-year-old, I understand why that was, you know, maybe big themes, tough. But now do you think of the brilliance that book is?
Absolutely. It unlocked for me. I knew it was brilliant then. I didn't have anyone to talk about it with. But I knew that it was something that I could work to understand at another time. But just seeing something, you know, pain, some familiarity, and just the magic of her words. Like, I was okay at that age with not understanding. And even now, every time I read it 30 times later, it's still like, oh, that semicolon has to mean hundreds of years of something. Something!
Lou,
yes.
Tell me about your thoughts on Toni Morrison.
Toni Morrison. Like Takiya, I think my first read was when I was about 14. I started out with Tar Baby. And within a month after reading that, I had to read The Bluest Eye and then everything. There was never a time where I felt an author who resonated so much with me, particularly as a young black young lady trying to find my way in life. I've always read. I've been reading voraciously for years, but she was the first that I most connected with and resonated so much with me, probably because of her characters. I mean, we were speaking about it a few days ago. It was like characters that are in our neighborhood. So, I mean, reading, you can go on a journey, you can experience different things, but that resonated so much with me because it was so much of my life. So that was my initial introduction to Toni and just wanting to read more and more and more.
In her own way, did she open doors for writers and women like you?
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, there were people who were of color and women writing before her, but not in the way in what she did. So that, I feel like it gave us that understanding that we would be able to write that way as well.
Leslie C. Youngblood.
Yes.
Toni Morrison.
Wow. You know, I would say, thinking about what Lou and Takiya have said, it reminds me, honestly, of a quote, a Maya Angelou quote that says, to paraphrase, you may forget what someone said, but you'll never forget how they made you feel. And when I think about Morrison, you may forget the names of the characters, you may forget certain circumstances, but you will never forget how you felt when you read that passage, how you felt when you understood that that character could be you, your mother, your grandmother, your uncle. That's the feeling that Baldwin invoked in me, and it's certainly the feeling that Morrison invoked. I felt a connection, and my first, honestly, I came about Morrison and Baldwin late. I was in my probably mid-20s before someone actually put Baldwin in my hands, and then from there, I just went on this, I have to read every Black American author's Black, and I fell into a, thank goodness, The Bluest Eye was my first Morrison book. And I tell you, there could not be a Georgie Matthews and Love Like Sky without there being a Pecola Breedlove in The Bluest Eye. They're just connected. Even if I didn't know that's what I was doing, that's what I was doing.
Well, let's listen to a couple clips. And the first one's actually the second clip, I think, that I had queued up here, Megan. And that's in this case, it's Toni Morrison talking about writing particular characters and why she occasionally wanted to write young Black girls. And the power of finally giving people a chance to see themselves and to hear themselves. And let's listen to Toni Morrison.
You've got the most vulnerable people in the world, which are children, female children, female Black children who have never held center stage in anything. If they appear in a book, they're a joke or, you know, just some color, local color, or a little walk-on part. The least important. Now, Black women have sometimes held center stage in some books by Blacks, even sometimes by white. But then, you know, they were maids, cooks, housekeepers, you know, they were really running. But the children were always lesser. So I wanted to have a little hurt Black girl at the center of this story. And it was difficult because focusing on her only was just too depressing, you know, because
yes.
You lose some of the thrill of being young. There is some thrill to it, you know.
Yes.
So that's what made me think of you, Leslie C. Youngblood. I have to say, it made me think of Love Like Sky.
You know, and when I think about that, that is what Morrison means to me. It is, even though, as Lou said, they were writers who, of course, wrote about Black characters prior to Morrison, Virginia Hamilton, just to name one. But Morrison gave me that permission to say, this is Georgie's story. This is about Georgie. And she's not the best friend. She's not the sidekick. She's not the comic relief. This is her story. And when a Black girl specifically holds that book, they can say, this is for me. This is mine. And anyone else who loves it, I love that. But Morrison gave me that permission, that okay, to say, I don't have to explain. And as we, when we study Morrison, we learn about the white gaze, and we know that there's no explanation to certain things that happen in Love Like Sky because Georgie knows, her family knows. So if I say something like putting Crown Royal or coconut oil in her hair, I don't have to explain that. As with, if I was speaking and in directing it to another audience, I would. But Georgie knows, and that's important, and that's what matters.
We're going to get back to that theme of what the white gaze is and what our guests think about that, because Toni Morrison had a lot to say about that in her life. And that was important to her in some ways to understand what that was in context. We're going to get back to that in just a second. But You know, if you missed the conversation, was it last fall that Love Like Sky came out?
Yes, November 2018.
Yeah, and so one of the parts of the conversation we had with Leslie at the time of the release of the book was the fact that initially the cover might not have included a young black girl.
Right.
But you wanted it to include Georgia.
And thank goodness I had an editor that backed me, but the initial cover was a big heart. And the cover, and Georgie was lighter in complexion. And there was also, marketing told me from Disney that this cover would be more marketable, mm-hmm. A more generic cover, not a cover with an African-American, especially a dark-complected African-American girl front and center. People would think it's a black book. But my response to that was, and that's okay. They can think it's a black book. But marketing said, you know, we want to get more buyers. And so at the end of the day, I had to believe that that was okay. My editor believed that it was okay. And
is there a little Toni Morrison in that?
Well, it has to be. I don't even think that, I can't even say that that was my mindset at the moment, but because I knew that that was my audience, and Morrison gives us permission to say that is my audience and that is okay. Not that is my audience and somehow I'm deficient, or that is my audience and somehow is less than. She said, this is my audience, this is okay, and the themes are universal. So it was okay, it should have been okay, and with Love Like Sky, that's just what it was, and I'm excited about it.
Well, you just heard Leslie mention something that I also mentioned in the intro to this program called The White Gaze, and I want to read from Time Magazine's remembrance of Toni Morrison on that specific idea. Quote, Morrison began work on her first novel, The Bluest Eye, which depicted a victimized adolescent black girl obsessed by white beauty standards and who begs God to turn her eyes blue. I wanted to read this book, and no one had written it yet, so I thought that maybe I would write it in order to read it, Morrison told The Guardian in 2015. She hoped to write a novel devoid of the white gaze, which she felt hovered over the work of even the most celebrated black writers, like Ralph Ellison and Frederick Douglass. I've spent my entire life trying to make sure the white gaze was not the dominant one in any of my books, Morrison said in the 2019 documentary, Toni Morrison, The Piece as I Am. So you mentioned the white gaze. Let's ask all of you what you make of how that impacts literature, and let's go around the table. Takiyah, what do you think?
So I think that literature is reflective of what's happening in the world, that if you grow up in a place that's anti-black, as we know America is and can be, no matter if you feel very strongly beautiful about your blackness, every day you have to confront overwhelming images that say you are not good enough. And so when you play those images over and over in your mind, and when you respond to those images without even thinking, like, you don't really mean to be conscious of having a light skin character. You don't mean to be conscious of talking respectability. You don't mean to be conscious of telling young people that they must speak a certain way. But those are the things that the white gaze does. And when you have artists, and I mean artists like Toni Morrison and others, who are very conscious of what systemic and institutionalized racism has done to black people in this country, what the horrors of enslavement have done to black folks across the diaspora, we understand that the white gaze is something that even the most prolific writer who is pro-black has to be conscious of, because we are told in this country that white is right, you know? And so someone like Morrison, who has a microphone or who has a pen or who has a stage, and she says, I am not going to center whiteness. I'm going to center myself in everything that I do, and I will not even honor a conversation that questions why, because I am black and I am enough. And to quote from Setha, or to Paul D talking to Setha, you are your best thing. And I think that's the message that Toni Morrison has given to black people over and over again. You are your best thing, and the white gaze does not get to dictate to you how you should be formed.
And just a little background on what Takiyah, when Takiyah says that Toni Morrison wouldn't even honor questions that sort of tried to center back to whiteness, I think what you're talking about, referring to, is just as one example of the many interviews I was watching with Toni Morrison leading up to this, you know, she would not be afraid to tell interviewers the question you just asked is racist, because you wouldn't ask a white author, how come you didn't write this black experience or this black character? But you do that to black writers, and I'm just not going to sort of play ball with it. Is that what you mean by that?
Exactly. And Leslie spoke to that as well. So the expectation is that when you center whiteness, as we know that the industry does and the world does, you say everything that I have to say has to be filtered through a white lens. And so making the decision to center blackness is something that is still in 2019 very controversial. And so hats off to Toni Morrison for sticking to, you know, her own independent mindset and saying that I'm going to free my people through my pen and I'm going to do it the way I want to do it.
And just to jump in on that, from that interview, and I can't think of who she was speaking with, but she told the interviewer, to paraphrase, it is inconceivable that you do not believe that I am the center. So to ask me to come to the center means by default that I am not the center, that I cannot be the center in the book that I write. And so that in alone in itself, as she said, is a racist question that some people did not understand. And she uses the example of Tolstoy. Would you ask Tolstoy, why do you write about Russia? Why do you write about Russians? That is what we get when we're asked, oh, in your next book, will G-Baby have a white friend? Will you make her, you know, something that makes people feel, okay, now I see myself in this? When we have read book after book after book where we do not see ourselves and we look to the universals of the messages in the book. There was not an effort for me purposely not to include Georgie's immediate friends as being a white people. It's just that in her world, these were her friends. And I thank goodness to people like Morrison said, you know, that's okay.
Okay. Lou, what do you make of the white gaze?
excuse me. Allergies are kind of crazy today. primarily, both of them hit the nail right on the head. The only thing I would add is, for me, the white gaze also is reflective in black writers who write, and it's with trying to educate or prove ourselves or for white people. One interview I watched or listened to, Toni Morrison was talking about Ralph Ellison and The Invisible Man. And the question arose to me, who were you invisible to? Mm-hmm. You were invisible to white people. So it's a brilliant book. I read it in my African-American lit class at MCC years ago. And I love the book, but when Morrison brought up that notion of the white gaze, I mean, it's something that not only we combat against people who are asking these questions of why don't you write about more white characters, but ourselves as black writers,
exactly,
making sure that we're genuine and authentic and writing for ourselves and not so that white people will understand or sympathize, or it's just we're writing. We're just telling truth. We're being ourselves.
And I'm just trying to be all of your student at this point and understand better, because if Toni Morrison said even Ralph Ellison and Frederick Douglass had, you know, elements of the white gaze as she would think of it in their writing, there's probably complex reasons for that, I would assume. Some of it is, you know, some writers might decide, I have to, in order to sort of commercialize work. Some might reflexively not even realize that that I'm sort of recentering it away from, you know, my own identity. And I wonder why we think that happens most often. Why do you think the white gaze ends up in the work of black writers?
Well, because whiteness is the default of America. And so if you don't look into the mirror...
Is that subconscious?
Of course, it's subconscious for black people and minoritized populations, but the power structure is constructed to be what it is. You have to have a hierarchy, right? And so if you've been in this system, indoctrinated, educated, whatever, you believe that whiteness is best. And so what ends up happening... I tell my students this, as much as I love black people and I love black people, I have to make a concerted effort every single day to make sure that I am not playing into the white gaze. I have to make sure that any interaction that I'm having with a black person has not been funneled through white supremacy. And I think that to say that out loud is to be very honest about what America has done to black people and their identities. And I think that bringing it back to Toni Morrison is she gives folk a language to be able to say that maybe I cannot talk to you in the ways that I want to. And I know that this neighborhood is messed up, you know, and Lou and I were having this conversation about Pecola, and Pecola Bree Love's family is black and ugly. And she says that, and I'm bringing it forward to Tressie McMillan Cottom's book, Thick. And she talks about being this ugly black woman. And she says, it's not that I'm really ugly. I'm filtering how white people see me. And so she says, I want you to know, I know that I'm beautiful, but whiteness sees me as ugly. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to challenge that notion. And what Morrison has done is she's challenged the notion of how black people can tell our stories. And so by privileging that, she's very conscious about, listen, I'm not doing that. So when you think of someone like Frederick Douglass, who, you know, ended up marrying a white woman and living in Rochester, New York, and having his house burnt down and being run out of town or whatever, of course he did, because many of his patrons were white folks. And so those sorts of things, if you come outside of your neighborhoods, every other thing that you do, from school to the medical care you receive to going to the bank to any other interaction you have outside of your black family, is going to be white. So black people always come in contact with white people, but white people don't always come in contact with black people.
And so that white gaze, maybe we see it in things like news stories about people, African-Americans, dismissed from jobs because of wearing their hair naturally.
What grows out of your head? Can you imagine? Coming here and they firing you for your hair.
But then we see maybe even the echoes of Toni Morrison and artists like Lizzo, you know, who are mm-hmm. proud of who they are, what their identity is, what they look like, and they're going to sing about it, and they're going to tell their stories, and they're not going to apologize for it. And by the way, Lizzo's Tiny Desk concert for NPR was NPR's best Tiny Desk.
I saw it.
And listeners, great. you got to look it up.
I'm sorry. Yeah. We are Lizzo fans. Yeah.
You've got, see, look, we're connecting Toni Morrison to Lizzo. That's Toni right. Morrison. Yeah. Toni Morrison was everywhere. After our only break of the hour, which let's do that now. And then what I want to do is this. I want listeners to, if you have any thoughts on Toni Morrison when you first encountered the work of Toni Morrison, and you know, let's be blunt. I mean, maybe you're a white listener who didn't read Toni Morrison growing up. We've talked to English teachers in local school districts, and they say, look, all the books we teach, all they're great. Great works of fiction, great narratives, no black writers. Not some districts, not even Toni Morrison cracking into the canon. And so the question is that changing? 844-295-TALK. If you want to join the program, it's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Email the program, connections@wxxi.org. As we talk about Toni Morrison with Leslie C. Youngblood, the author of Love Like Sky. Takiya Graham is an English professor and a founder of the, let's see here, the We All Write Black Women's Writing Collective. And a member is Lou Highsmith, who is also program director of Luke Creations Production and a former leader of the Rock Bottom Slam Poetry Team. And we're going to come back and listen to some of Toni Morrison's thoughts about white supremacy. That's next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we talk about pay equity and the impact of pay disparities for African-American women in particular. Join us for that discussion first hour. In our second hour, a conversation about the Clarissa Street Reunion, the largest independently African-American festival in Rochester, is coming up this weekend. Talk with you Tuesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about the career, the legacy, the impact of Toni Morrison, who recently passed away at the age of 88. She had a lot to say about race throughout her life. At the age of just 2, her white landlord tried to burn down her family's home because they, according to the landlord, were late on a rent payment, and he wanted them gone. Her family witnessed lynchings, all kinds of racial episodes that impacted especially her father, but certainly members of her family and Toni Morrison's worldview herself. And this is her talking to Charlie Rose back in, I think, 2008. And they were talking about these various themes and the question of what white supremacy is and how Toni Morrison views it. And I want to listen to that now.
Don't you understand that the people who do this thing, who practice racism,
right,
are bereft? There is something distorted about the psyche. It's a huge waste, and it's a corruption and a distortion. It's a profound neurosis. that nobody examines for what it is. It feels crazy. It is crazy. And it leaves, it has just as much of a deleterious effect on white people and possibly equal as it does black people. I always knew that I had the moral high ground all my life. I always thought those people who said I couldn't come in the drugstore and I had to sit in these funny places, I couldn't go in the park.
You felt morally superior to them from day one.
And I thought they knew that I knew that they were inferior to me morally. I always thought that. And my parents always thought that.
You said your father was racist because he always felt like
he was superior. That's right. He always felt superior. And that was a form, you know, of defensive racism. But if the racist white person, I don't mean the person who is examining his consciousness and so on, doesn't understand that he or she is also a race, it's also constructed, it's also made, and it also has some kind of serviceability. But when you take it away, I take your race away, and there you are, all strung out, and all you got is your little self. And what is that? What are you without racism? Are you any good? Are you still strong? You still smart? You still like yourself? I mean, these are the questions. It's part of it is, yes, the victim, how terrible it has been for black people.
But you don't like that.
I'm not a victim. I refuse to be one.
And the victim is the other person who is morally inferior and
that's
who
what, that's a serious question.
On to
of course.
Racism
if you have
somehow,
to hold, that's
for his or her own self-esteem and definition.
If you can only be tall because somebody's on their knees, then you have a serious problem. And my feeling is white people have a very, very serious problem. And they should start thinking about what they can do about it.
Toni Morrison talking to Charlie Rose. I want to ask all of our guests if they want to weigh in on some of those themes that you heard there. I'll start with Takiya.
So this is the only time I take a little issue with Toni Morrison, because I think that I've read the quote, I've seen the interview, that when you talk about racism, that defensive racism is not a category, I would say, that exists for black people. You cannot be racist if you're black.
You can be prejudiced, but not racist.
Exactly. You can be biased or whatever. And yeah. I understand the defensiveness.
Racism is about power.
That's right. That's right. And I also think that particularly for those of us who are in the academy or, you know, consider ourselves public intellectuals, that there's a privilege in having a philosophical conversation about a moral high ground. Like, if you can feed your family, if you can, you know, find a place to stay, if you don't have to worry about being incarcerated or pulled over by the police, then you can have a philosophical conversation about the impacts of race and being on the moral high ground. But the rest of us live in the real world who, and I just experienced this last night. There was a car accident on my street, and a white woman's car was hit by a black woman's car, which was, you know, not an issue until the police officer came. Everything was civil. And the lady actually hit our car, and the white woman, my neighbor, runs and says, she was going to run away. And I came off my porch. I said, I have to tell you, that's not true. She was not going to run away. Her car was here. She's been here for 10, 15 minutes. I said, the minute you said that, you triggered something else that put her life in danger, depending on the police officer. So when Toni Morrison uses words like black people having defensive racism or saying that, you know, there's a moral high ground, I get it. Like, okay, we're better people. But when you live with the actual realities of day-to-day racism and you really feel that, then you can't wax philosophical about it.
Okay. Lou?
For me, and I've watched and seen that interview at least a good 5 times.
Right.
The first time I watched it, I was just excited that she was able to express a lot of things that I feel that we think or feel. And her doing it in that form with Charlie Rose was profound for me, particularly with the moral high ground. I feel like we've been raised to take that primarily as children, because we know what we're dealing with and how to navigate this world where white supremacy in America is prevalent, whether people want to admit it or not. I feel like it's something that and Toni has said it. It's not something where, okay, we fought racism, it's over. Okay, we ended slavery, it's over. We had the civil rights movement, we're done. It's an ongoing, I'd say, I can't even say a battle, something, it's a disease that we continue to combat, and I feel like it gets better in moments where it looks like it's gotten better, and then something happens, and we see a lot of what we're seeing right now in America. So for me, yeah, the defense of racism, I can understand a lot of older African-Americans who were brought up in the South who may have what one might call a defensive racism.
Or maybe defensive prejudice.
Yes. I can understand that. I can't say that we may see things totally the same, but I understand where it comes from.
Toni Morrison said her father found himself superior to all white people and just decided, based on his experiences and his interactions, mm-hmm. that's how he came to view the world. So I understand Takiya's point very strongly that if we're using the term racism, it's not just prejudice. It's prejudice plus power. And so I think that distinction is fair. But the rest of the clip resonates with you, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Leslie?
Well, it definitely, you know, resonates as far as I've listened to several Morrison interviews within the last few days, just trying to understand, to really center myself in a world that no longer has Toni Morrison's voice in the present, even though we have it in words. And just recently, she was talking about what a life there is to for a person to be so racist that they could take it out on a child. Mm-hmm. That what is that? That inhumane thing that would make these white mothers turn over a bus, spit on black children. What is that? And because she could never have that, being a mother, being someone who cares about people in general, what level of hatred is that, that you can turn that against children? And I think if she's talking about taking a moral high ground, she said that she could not gather black women to do such a thing, but she's seen it in white people gathering to harm the least of these, which would be children, out of racism, out of a fear of losing, even though privilege probably wasn't into play then as a buzzword, but that's what it was. We would lose this center if this person comes into our school, or we don't want our children, as, believe it or not, when we talk about colorism, that's a whole other story, but there was another quote where Morrison said that her grandmother, who was a dark-complected woman, looked at Morrison and said, "You've been tampered with," meaning that, you know, you have somehow been dirtied by the white race. But what we're saying as far as Morrison in dealing with children and dealing with this concept of how can you hate a people that much that you would be willing to put this hatred on children? And when you take the moral high ground, maybe that's what she's talking about in that instance as well.
Yeah, I think of the video clips from one I'm remembering from the 1970s, but there are so many more of black families moving into predominantly white neighborhoods. We're talking about, again, kids who are 8, 10, 12, and just the way the mobs of people would stand around taunting, yelling, "Get out of here, we don't want..."
Right, the calling the N-word.
To say nothing of physical violence.
Right, and, you know, we there's Emmett Till. There's so many names of just violence on children, which I think she's using this as the measuring stick of how can you be that devoid of humanity that is your go-to, and that becomes instilled in a lot that we still see today.
I'm going to get to your phone calls in just a moment here. Let me read an email from Angela, who says, "Evan, when I was growing up as a white girl in a suburban school, not one author of color that I remember, and certainly not one book by Toni Morrison, not period, one period, book, period." Mm. So,
and it still can happen now.
T- Takiya, I know you wanted to address this. That's Angela's email. Now, she's saying when she was growing up, I don't know how old Angela is or when she was in school, but that's probably my experience. I mean, I don't remember everything that was assigned reading. What are you seeing right now?
So for me, under my other title, I'm an equity and inclusion strategist, and I'm often brought into school districts, local ones, and across the state to talk about cultural inclusion in literature. And in our neighboring districts to the city of Rochester, there are many school systems here who are not teaching books with Black students. And I don't mean just picking a book off the shelf and saying, I'm going to teach this book. I mean really immersing yourself in the knowledge of a culture and finding ways that you can make these conversations continue. And so when I hear, I want to connect two things. When Toni Morrison says, and Leslie, I love that you talked about she couldn't fathom in some ways how you could do this to children. Well, all we have to do is look at enslavement and look at Beloved, and we see that absolutely there's a prescription in a past history of doing this. And then when you look in 2019, those images you say happened in the 1970s, we can look on media anytime and see those same sorts of communities of people, white folks, spitting on children, burning some torches, and don't want people in there. So those things are still very common. You know, the clothing has changed and some of the language is different. But to see in 2019 that there are still school districts who are not teaching Black texts. And there's so many ways to get to. You can go on Twitter and follow a number of different hashtags. You know, we need diverse books. Of course, you can get Leslie's books and her upcoming book as well. You know, and you can really find ways to immerse yourself in the literature of folks who are minoritized in this country. But we still see that. And don't just do it during Black History Month or Hispanic Heritage Month or Native American History Month. You find a ways to put these characters and have the conversations all the time so it becomes more normalized.
But
your book has some news to it, by the way.
News.
So before I jump to the phone, I want to make sure we hit this news about Love Like Sky, which has been out for the better part of a year now. What's the news?
Yes, the news that it has been acquired, the rights to Love Like Sky has been acquired by Scholastic, which means that it will be available at Scholastic book fairs, Scholastic book clubs, and basically there is no excuse for someone not to have access to it. And also, it has been chosen as a Louisiana state book, which is just great for any title to be chosen as a state book, you know, and all of that is great, and I love that Love Like Sky is moving in that direction. But when we talk about books in schools and when we talk about teachers, we're talking about, do they have a fear of not being able to fully engage in the text? Sometimes, even from my experience as being an assistant professor, I know that professors will stick with what they know, what they're comfortable with.
Not all of us.
Yeah. Oh, not all of us. Definitely not all of us. Not all.
Well, I guess so far, congratulations on
that. Thank you.
But then the question becomes, how many classrooms do we see this kind of book in? And
not a lot, not enough. And I'm sure, because keep in mind, my experience, I inquired, let me see, Richard Wright maybe in high school. But Richard Wright was about it for me in high school. And that was it. And that was, quote unquote, a protest novel. But there were other writers out there. And as one of my writing friends, Linda Sue Park, says, it's not that writers were not there. It's that I was not privy to them. No one introduced them to me, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
Can we shout out Women's Foundation of Genesee Valley for a moment? Because I chair their after-school literacy program, and last year I chose Leslie's book. We bought 1,000 copies of Love Like Sky for our annual event, and so we started giving the books away in November when the book came out free of charge. So 1,000 girls in the city of Rochester and neighboring counties and communities were able to get this book from our organization, our free event every year. So we chose that book, and just in support of Leslie, I was one of her early readers and absolutely loved the book. So I just wanted to shout Women's Foundation of Genesee Valley out.
And that is what I'm... So with Women's Foundation choosing Love Like Sky, not only was that amazing to do, and apologize, I didn't know if I was able to mention other names. I appreciate it. But that puts the book in hands of people even outside of the classroom, which is important. It's important to see a text where a Black child is represented first and foremost in the classroom, but it's also great for recreational reading. So that means that a child can say, hey, this is just a book that I can read on my own. And with Genesee Women's Foundation to make it something that becomes, in their mind, a norm. It's normalized to say, hey, a person that looks like me is on the cover, and is validated in that sense.
And Toni, this is something Toni Morrison talked about the importance of in her life many, many times. So as we jump to the phones, shout out to all the teachers who are listening, especially, you know, before you go back. I'm not somebody who thinks teachers don't work in the summer. Don't worry. But you have a little bit more time to listen to Connections. And if you're a teacher, we appreciate that. If you're a teacher who wants to put Love Like Sky in your classroom, are you available to come talk to teacher students?
I am. Just email me, LeslieCYoungblood@gmail.com, and we can talk about it.
All right. As we're talking about the impact, the career, the life, and legacy of Toni Morrison, to the phones we go. Tadan in Rochester, first up. Go ahead.
Hi there. The nickname is Tedna. The name is Tedana, but Americans can't pronounce that. I would submit that we need to outgrow defining ourselves by nationhood. I went to school. My father was a diplomat. He was one quarter African-American and 1/16th Seneca, and I knew that in the 1950s. But I was beat up in school in China because I had round blue eyes. I was beat up in school in France because my skin was pale. I mean beaten. We have a black eye and a split lip. So I get very confused by these discussions about racism that act as if one group is in multiple jurisdictions. I would submit to you that in China, I was beat up because I was pale with round eyes. I was beat up in a dark-skinned school because I was medium-skinned. And I would submit that we need to get past nationally defined constructs about race and claim that we're a human race. By the way, I didn't enjoy getting beat up, and the last time I was 9 and I busted the big guy's jaw. Felt good.
Tedna, I'm sorry to hear about your own experiences.
I'm hearing everybody here limiting themselves to an experience of life based on living in a United States society where we have this prevalent apartheid of non-metro school jurisdictions. I volunteer at School 17 in the city.
Okay, well, Takia, do you want to start? Go ahead.
I absolutely do. I'm sorry that those things happened to you, but when we talk about nationality, that's very different than race. Race is a social construct, and it only has to do with skin color. And so even if I identify
myself... And eye shape, ma'am.
Yes. So, well, eye shade too, but if I have black skin and blue eyes, I still have black skin. So I'm sorry that those things have happened to you, but the conversation about national identity versus race are conflated. Those are not the same thing at all. And one of the things about it is that if you have fair skin in America, white skin in America, people deal with you very different as a whole class of people. We know individually that people are beaten up. We absolutely can recognize that. But the conversation that you're having takes away and it minimizes what ends up happening to black people. And so voices like Toni Morrison's are so important because she talks about centering blackness. And what you have done is dismissed the conversation and recentered yourself and talked about 1/16th of Native American identity, 1/4 of black identity, excuse me.
Is shed U.S. viewpoint and join a global world view.
And black people all over the globe throughout the diaspora are still being killed. Thank you very much.
So are Armenian people and Jewish
absolutely.
People?
Absolutely. Minoritized people across the globe. We all have taken history. So thank you and have a nice day.
This becomes an all lives matter versus black lives matter. Is when we talk about black lives matter, it suddenly becomes all lives matter.
That's right.
And we are talking about a situation where in the classroom in these United States, black kids can come in a classroom, complete all the way to 12th grade, and somehow never come in contact with a book by an African-American author that shows African-American people in the country in which they were born. That is problematic. If that becomes, and it's the, and even though I know teachers work hard,
yes.
But and I know that they mean well, but sometimes they rely on the canon. If The Kill a Mockingbird is the only book that will be in every single classroom, that's a problem. If that
or
is
Huck
the,
Finn
or
Huck
Finn,
Finn.
it's okay that I know Huck Finn and that sometimes they may want to center or not use the N word or get another version without the N word. But my niece can learn Huck Finn, but that's it. Learn The Killing Mockingbird, but that's it. That becomes a situation where a child that is in that classroom has to start to feel that I must not be important, that I must not be of value, because no one is talking about me. No one is talking about my mom or people who look like me, or they're not talking about people after enslavement, or they're not just centering it around a little girl for if she wants to have a black or the bluest eye, or if she wants to just say, my parents are divorced and I want to deal with that. That becomes issues that black kids can deal with. And I just want to say that I want a black kid that is in a classroom should be allowed to see themselves represented in text on a regular basis, not just during February. And we have to make that happen. And
white kids need to see black kids too, though.
Yes.
That was my next statement.
That's what it is. And I'll just say this.
That was my next statement.
When I'm at Barnes & Noble, when I see a white parent with her, she's looking for someone to give this book to. There's her daughter there. Mommy, I would like to read it. The mother has this aha moment that says, oh, wow. Maybe my 12-year-old daughter. This doesn't have to go to the daughter's black friend. This everyone benefits from reading outside of their actual experience. Everyone benefits from that.
Go ahead, Lou.
Yeah, pretty much I was just going to add that addendum to that. Growing up primarily in the city and then as a teenager, going to Gage Child Eye was culture shock for me. At the time, it was the 80s, and you could probably count the number of black folks in my class on two hands. But I had a teacher junior year who pretty much said, read whatever you want. It has to be okayed by me. And this is what your end of the year essay is on. I chose Alice Walker's The Color Purple. The teacher was fine with it. And I absolutely just went in on that essay, just so happy that I could write about Alice Walker and The Color Purple and not necessarily, you know, Ayn Rand's Fountainhead. You know, like it was just a joy to experience that in that environment. And I obviously had black and white friends. My white friend read it with me. We read The Color Purple together. We both wrote our essay on it. So I feel like it helped not only me, but it also helped her as far as broadening her horizons. If you're talking about things globally, that I don't understand why you would think emphasizing our culture and what we experience not resonating. I feel like it's, I don't know, not giving white people credit.
When I was in grad school, I would have people coming up to me, oh, you know, I don't like Toni Morrison, or I don't like Morrison's work, kind of baiting me to argue. I'm like, I'm not going to argue that with you. That's your loss. Because guess what? There are some of Faulkner's works that I find fine. There are some of Ulysses' work that I find great. So I'm not going to, but they would bait me with this, I don't like Morrison. And Morrison didn't center you in her work. Why would I center this conversation with you telling me that you don't like, how can you not, you don't have to like in every individual book, but to talk, to say that you don't appreciate her work, her contribution, that's your loss.
That phone call, Leslie's on one now. So we're let's get one more phone call in. This is Lisa and Hilton. We got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I was just, everything you're saying really resonates with me. I went to Gates. I actually graduated in 85 from Gates Child Eye. I had a lot of black friends. A lot of my friends were. And when I went to school and started reading things and having discussions, I started thinking, wow, we didn't read anything. You're right. We read Huckleberry Finn and we read, I can't think of the other one we
Kill
read.
Kill a Mockingbird? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, The Kill a Mockingbird. So anyways, it was 87. I was a nanny. I was taking primarily English classes. I was a liberal arts major at MCC. And we traveled to D.C. because they were looking for a home. And I had a night off. So I was sitting in the lobby of the hotel was drinking a glass of wine. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was 21, sitting in this beautiful armchair. And this woman was sitting across from me. And we started having this conversation. And she asked me what I did. Did I go to school? I told her I was really reading. I like to write, and I was reading a lot. And probably telling her a lot of the works that I read were a lot of classics. You know, I grew up reading Little House on the Prairie, and I'm reading Jane Austen and all that. And she just looked at me, and she had this, I'll never forget it. She had a twinkle in her eye, and she said, you really need to read some more modern works. And I said, okay. So I took that with me. And I took Literature of the Black Experience at MCC. And we read one of her books. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, my God. I was sitting with Toni Morrison drinking a glass of wine. I would have killed. To be able to ask her some questions.
Well, Lisa, that's an amazing way to help round out the program, because we're just about out of time. That's an amazing story to look back and say you had that experience. So let me ask all of our guests as we close the program, you're going to go back and read one Toni Morrison for our listeners who have barely dug into the work. What are you going to start with?
Song of Solomon.
Song of Solomon.
Sula.
Bluest Eye. Even though Beloved is my favorite. Bye.
I want to thank all of our guests for being here and discussing Toni Morrison, the legacy, and frankly, the legacy is reflected in so many different places that we talked about this hour. Sometimes even in music, sometimes in social conversation, the kind of books that are assigned in class, what the cover of a book looks like that you can pick up even at a Pittsford Barnes & Noble.
Exactly. Mm, that's right.
And I want to just thank our guests for helping lead that conversation. Leslie C. Youngblood is the author of Love Like Sky, which might be assigned one day to one of your children in class. Or maybe you pick it up just for pleasure reading.
Exactly.
Leslie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lou Highsmith, program director of Lou Creations Production, former leader of the Rock Bottom Slam Poetry Team, and a member of We All Write, Black Women's Writing Collective. Always nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our thanks to the founder of that collective, Takiya Graham, an English professor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gary Putup, thanks for the assistance today. And Bob behind the glass, Megan Mack, doing it all. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.